We can probably expect discriminatory laws to be enacted while everyone is in this collective fog that keeps their attention on the COVID pandemic and little else.
Nowadays, we can't go into each other's apartments and hold each other or touch each other. And I find that a very real issue nowadays for a lot of people is touch starvation.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Tunisia flip-flops on imported marriage equality, outcasters become incasters under lockdown, and an AIDS survivor answers COVID questions. All that and more this week because you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending May 2nd, 2020. The North African nation of Tunisia recorded its first legally recognized same-gender marriage, but only briefly. The Tunisian LGBTQ rights group Association Shams had announced late last week that the marriage in France of a gay Tunisian man and a gay Frenchman was registered in the capital city of Tunis. But local affairs minister Lofty Zitoun denounced the story as fake news a few days later. He called it an error committed by the municipality of Tunis and said that it has been rectified. The Republic of Tunisia is a predominantly Muslim country. LGBTQ citizens get no protections from discrimination, and of course, there is no marriage equality there. President Kais Saied vocally supports the continued criminalization of consensual adult same-gender sex. He's called LGBTQ people deviants. But Association Shams leader and lawyer Munir Batur is still very proud of the group's success. Batur said, "To my knowledge, Shams is now the only queer legal association in the Arab Muslim world. This is not nothing and offers us hardly believable opportunities, sometimes beyond our borders."
A nonprofit in Japan is not waiting for official government approval of marriage equality. The Fani'i Project is offering digital partnership certificates for lesbian and gay couples as a way to verify their relationships. Some progressive companies have been looking for a way to do that so that they can provide the same benefits to them that are offered to other partnered employees. Those benefits include family health insurance coverage, parental leave, and other perks given to coupled heterosexuals. National marriage equality is highly unlikely, given the ruling party's adamant refusal to even consider the issue. A number of municipalities in Japan have issued civil partnership certificates to same-gender couples, but their limited benefits are only available to residents of each municipality.
At least 17 companies have already signed on to the Fami'i Project, including the major investment bank Mizuho Financial Group and two insurance companies, Sampo Japan and Hotto Link. According to the Kyoto News Service, Mizuho has offered familial benefits to its queer workers since 2016, but cannot offer them unless the worker can provide proof of their relationship. The digital certificates being offered through the Fami'i Project solves that problem. Fami'i founder Koki Uchiyama told Reuters that their goal is to have at least 100 companies enrolled by July. Uchiyama said, "If we have a big network of corporations that support us, we can persuade the government to change the law." Perhaps wishful thinking, but a nice thought nevertheless.
A disturbing new report suggests that almost 1 in 5 Russians support the entire elimination of LGBTQ people. The non-governmental research group Levada Center's independent survey also found 32% of respondents want to isolate LGBTQ people from society. Just 9% said they wanted to support queers. The center has conducted the survey every year since 1989 to measure tolerance for people who deviate from socially acceptable norms. Actually, this year's numbers represent a slight increase in the acceptance of LGBTQ people in Russian society, 3% fewer people favor the elimination of queers than in 2015. The number favoring isolation was down 5%, and there was a 3% increase in respondents who said they wanted to support LGBTQ people. The survey published this week was conducted between February 20th and 26th. 1,614 respondents in 50 urban and rural regions of Russia participated. St. Petersburg lesbian activist Svetlana Sakharova expressed concerns that the survey results might spark even more anti-queer government actions, not to mention assaults against people perceived to be queer by nationalist thugs. However, she insists that Russians are not as homophobic as authorities or federal mass media try to portray them. While the survey results are far from ideal, Zakharova told NBC News that the situation is slightly changing for the better.
Caught up in a raid on the pretext of a COVID-19 lockdown violation, 19 Ugandan men perceived to be queer remain in jail with bail denied. Police rounded them up at a homeless shelter for sexual minorities on March 29th. The men range in age from 19 to 32. According to the Voice of America, 23 men were detained at the Children of the Sun Foundation shelter in the town of Kianjira, 10 kilometers southwest of the capital city, Kampala. 4 were released on medical grounds, but the other 19 have been behind bars ever since. Most of the men were outed during television coverage of the raid. The defendants are charged with conduct likely to cause the spread of an infectious disease. Bail was ostensibly denied out of fear that their release could further expose the population.
A police spokesman said that the officers made the arrests after complaints from neighbors and claimed that it had nothing to do with the men being gay. Gatherings of more than 5 people are outlawed under the Ugandan government's emergency lockdown rules. Veteran activist Frank Mugisha of Sexual Minorities Uganda said that the shelters for LGBTQ people have had to change policies under the lockdown. Shelters like the one in Kiengera often house queer young people who've been kicked out of their homes with nowhere else to go. Mugisha charged that only LGBTQ gatherings are being targeted for breaking the 5-person rule. Uganda is well known for being one of the worst places on earth to be queer. It's not known if any of the 19 detainees have actually been tested for coronavirus. Unless bail is unexpectedly granted, they're stuck in jail, a common breeding ground for COVID-19. Their first court hearing is scheduled for May 12th.
One of Kenya's most acclaimed films is still banned from screens at home. It's called Rafiki, Friend in Kiswahili, and it's about 2 young women falling in love. It was the first film from the East African country to debut at the Cannes Film Festival. The Kenya Film Classification Board banned Rafiki in April 2018 because it allegedly promotes homosexuality, and that's illegal in Kenya. This week, the Constitutional Court upheld the ban, rejecting charges that it was muzzling freedom of expression in the overwhelmingly Christian nation. The film's producer, Wanuri Kahiyu, vowed to appeal to the nation's Supreme Court. She told Reuters that the ruling is not a true reflection of what the Constitution says.
The chief of the Byron, Georgia Fire Department is suing the city and federal court for wrongful termination after she came out as transgender. Rachel Mosby was hired in 2007 as fire marshal of Byron, a farming region outside of Macon, Georgia, with about 4,500 residents. She was promoted to chief in January 2008 to lead its first professional fire department. She was fired by the city administrator last June for allegedly poor performance. Despite nary a mention of her transgender status, the lawsuit Mosby filed last week contends that in reality, the termination was based on her sex, gender identity, and notions of sex stereotyping. It argues that Mosby spent years developing the fire department from the ground up, secured funding to pay for equipment, and improved the department's rating that insurance companies use to help determine a community's fire risk. The city denies that her transition was a factor in the termination. The U.S. Supreme Court heard cases testing federal anti-discrimination protections for LGBTQ workers in October. It may be the ultimate arbiter of cases just like Mosby's. A ruling there is expected in June.
Finally, this is what democracy looks like. A lesbian former deputy sheriff in Hamilton County, Ohio, has won the Democratic primary, defeating her former boss, the guy she's suing for wrongful termination. Charmaine McGuffey crushed incumbent Sheriff Jim Neal by a nearly 70% margin. She'll face a Cincinnati police lieutenant on the November ballot who ran unopposed in the Republican primary. McGuffey was responsible for jail and court services. Under her tenure, the Hamilton County Justice Center went from being the lowest-ranked large jail system in Ohio to the best in the state. Neal actually admitted to firing McGuffey for being a lesbian, claiming that it created a hostile work environment. McGuffey's federal lawsuit also charges that she was fired for expressing concerns about excessive use of force by sheriff's deputies. The lawsuit is still pending. Neal was already unpopular in Democratic circles for being too conservative. He even appeared at a Donald Trump rally in 2016. So it's no surprise that the local Democratic Party's nominating committee endorsed his primary challenger. McGuffey has said that she believed she would win, but by 70%? She said, "I didn't know it would be that large."
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending May 2nd, 2020. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is usually recorded in the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, but during the COVID-19 emergency, we are recording remotely. The news is written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazor, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more.
And you can listen to NewsWrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out Radio YouTube channel. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V. Stay healthy.
And I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Stay safe.
Another thing that I think is important to remember right now is a lesson that we learned in the 80s and 90s, and that is the need to believe in ourselves.
Hear how one long-term AIDS survivor is using old lessons to face a new pandemic later in the program. But first,
hi-ho, hi-ho.
Working or finding workarounds during the COVID-19 crisis is a daily challenge for everyone, and our outcasting friends are getting even more creative to get it done.
The COVID pandemic has upended life all over the world. People are trying to maintain some level of sanity and normalcy while complying with stay-at-home orders, working from home, and physical distancing, and that includes us at Outcasting. Hi, I'm Sarah, and this is Outcasting Plus, a production of Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. I was a member of Outcasting during my high school years from 2016 to 2017. Now I'm in college. I came back to visit Outcasting this past winter break, and now I'm back on a longer-term basis because my college is closed because of the COVID pandemic. I'm glad to be back, but I'm also missing attending classes in person and spending time with my friends and extended family. The COVID pandemic has also dramatically changed the way we work at Outcasting, and so we thought we'd talk a little bit about how things work behind the scenes here at Outcasting, during normal times and now. Since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, gathering to work in the studio hasn't been possible. We're based just outside of New York City, which has been an early epicenter of the coronavirus in the United States. Around mid-March, it became clear that we'd have to stop meeting in person until it was safe to do so again. It means a lot to us to be able to produce reliable, uninterrupted content, so we had to find ways to continue our work without being able to meet in person. Ultimately, we decided to break our usual once-a-week 3-hour session into 2 2-hour sessions. These e-sessions are held using an online platform called Discord, which acts like a giant conference call and allows us to talk and text in several simultaneous channels. We also continue to use Google Docs to work collaboratively. Creating radio content outside of our studio is challenging. We have just 3 microphones that we can use to record in our homes, and it's not easy to pass them around, considering the requirement for physical distancing. In some cases, including this commentary, we have to use computer headsets. And with so many people around the country and around the world homebound and streaming video, it seems that existing internet infrastructure is struggling to keep up. At least in our experience, we're having much more difficulty than usual in getting steady internet connections that can transmit good quality audio. Even in normal circumstances, home Wi-Fi networks can be unreliable, so it usually takes several tries before we can get usable audio. So all of our recording takes longer, sometimes much longer, and requires a lot more time to edit. Also, the acoustics of our homes don't measure up to those in our studio. Reverberation and outside noise are nearly unavoidable. So our audio quality, which we really care about, has been affected. Working from home instead of the studio also leads to a decrease in productivity. When we're at home, we're sort of in a more relaxed headspace, which can work against us as we try to stay focused on creating high-quality content. As a result, despite the fact that we're technically meeting for more raw time now, we are a bit less productive overall. In order to produce content about the coronavirus, we've pushed back other projects. We had to accelerate the timeline for our coronavirus episode. The turnaround time was just a few weeks. Despite these challenges, we're working to keep things going. We figured that if network TV news anchors, reporters, and guests can go on the air from their living rooms, we can work with less than ideal recording conditions, and we think that you'll forgive us for our decreased audio quality. It means a lot to be able to continue producing content. Our mission is to unite LGBTQ youth, straight allies, and the power of media in advocacy for a less unjust world. And it's still important, especially in these times when coronavirus seems like the only thing on anyone's mind. We've already seen how some states are using the COVID pandemic to restrict women's access to their constitutional right to abortion. Just recently, the state of Idaho enacted a sweeping law limiting the ability of transgender people to participate in sports. We can probably expect other discriminatory laws to be enacted while everyone is in this collective fog that keeps their attention on the COVID pandemic and little else. It's important for the media to continue to cover important issues in the world, and we hope you agree. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
With a
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens, Noah in the Noah's Ark movie and TV series, and you've discovered This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities and those who love them.
Reverend Steve Peters is one of the longest living AIDS survivors in the United States. He served numerous AIDS activist and religious organizations, was director of Metropolitan Community Church's AIDS Ministry from 1987 to 1997, met with President Bill Clinton in 1993, and famously drew tears from televangelist Tammy Faye Baker in a live interview. This Way Out associate producer Lucia Chappelle donned her theologian's hat to talk with Rev. Steve over Zoom about how life in coronavirus isolation reminds him of life during the AIDS years.
I have a friend, his name is Lonely, he's always by my side. He borrows all my confidence and steals all my pride.
It reminds me of the early years of AIDS in some ways. It just touches all of those fears and the isolation and, you know, the touch, being touch starved because people are so afraid, the fear keeps coming back to the fear, you know.
Something I noticed the other day when I went to take a walk, I turned the corner and there was a woman turning the corner coming next to me and she wouldn't make eye contact.
Yeah, I was taking a walk today, and a woman who's a neighbor down the street came out of her garage and started up the stairs to her place, and she, like, made a point of not looking at me, you know, and, like, hello?
We can wave from 6 feet away.
Right.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what isolation taught you about your faith.
Well, thank you for asking that question. That's a good question. The isolation from AIDS, I mean, you know, I can think of many nights when I felt so all alone because of being so sick with AIDS in 82 and 83. I found that what really helped was if I invited Jesus into my bed, and that incarnational kind of experience was very healing and comforting and reassuring to me. And now I'm finding that I need to remember to invite God or Jesus or Buddha or whoever into the room and be my companion. And I find that peace from meditation and prayer, as well as just breathing. You know, it's so important that we all remember to breathe. And I think just taking a deep breath helps me with the isolation. Sounds weird, but it does. Another thing that I've noticed in terms of the difference between the 80s with AIDS and now with COVID is that, you know, in the 80s, in the early 80s, I was sick and housebound, but I had visitors. The women came into my apartment or in my little house as much as, you know, you could, and you touched me and you held me and you taught me about the rhythms of illness and the body and that sort of thing. It was the women who helped us in the early years of AIDS, who reached out beyond the fear, bridged the fear somehow. And nowadays, we can't go into each other's apartments and hold each other or touch each other. And I find that a very real issue nowadays for a lot of people is touch starvation. How do we touch each other? How do we feed that need for touch without physically touching each other? That's a big issue, I think, for all of us right now.
I've been kind of Twitter addicted. Trying to talk to people on Twitter and interacting and commenting, but it's hollow. Mm-hmm. And I've often thought that when we do our worship and our connecting and all these things electronically,
yes,
we can't lose our sense of Christ being incarnate.
That's right.
You know, we worship an incarnate God. That's
yes.
That's what really struck me about what you said about inviting Jesus into your bed. Mm-hmm. That intimacy, that physical closeness. Mm-hmm. We are not God. Incarnating exactly. now.
Exactly. Yes.
You know.
That's a good way to put it. That's excellent. 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 And you know, another thing that I think is important to remember right now is a lesson that we learned in the 80s and 90s, and that is the need to believe in ourselves. When I was going around the UFMCC, the fellowship all over the world, preaching and teaching about AIDS, I carried this fairy wand with me, and I used it to talk about how good fairies were dying because people don't believe in them or us.
Mm-hmm.
And so with all these good fairies dying, it was important to believe in ourselves and believe in each other and believe in God, but to believe in ourselves that God is with us and that healing still happens, whether it be into life or into death. So healing into life or healing into death is something that happens, but it requires this fairy dust, you know, of believing.
I'm reminded of a line from Elmer Gantry. They're talking about whether or not he believes in God, and he says he doesn't know, and she says, well, you know, that's all right if you don't believe in God. God believes in you.
Ah, wonderful, yes.
You know.
That's so important to mm-hmm. know and mm-hmm. to feel mm-hmm. and to internalize, to bring inside yourself. And I think, too, that we're doing something that's also really important right now that I learned a lot about when I was sick with AIDS, and that is the importance of laughter, you know, that we keep laughing, that we keep finding the joy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there was a great saying in the AIDS years that silence equals death, action equals life. And in doing action, in taking action, we are creating hope. Hopelessness and helplessness are very much involved with each other.
Yes.
And when you discover that there's a lot you can do to help yourself, then, or a lot you can do to help others, then you begin to heal. You begin to find hope. You begin to find the joy again. Yeah,
it's so weird with this thing, because the thing that we have to do is do nothing.
Right.
The thing we have to do to be effective and active is to stay home.
I know.
There's such a tension there. But there's stuff going on, and there's letters to be written, and there's Congress people to be contacted, and there are more things we can be doing. And I'm realizing in myself that I haven't acted on a lot of those things because it's just been so darn hard to get my own stuff together.
Mm-hmm. It's believing in yourself enough to do the work of self-care.
Exactly. Exactly. And then after doing that stuff, after
you have to put your
self-care, realizing that you can be impactful.
Yes.
Because you are a powerful, empowered person by taking care of yourself.
You have to put on your own oxygen mask before you can put on the oxygen mask of the people next to you. And when you do, then you take action. And there's so much that needs to be done. I mean, this crisis is challenging our healthcare system in a way that could be absolutely disastrous. I mean, there are how many millions of people that don't have health insurance? What are they going to do when they get sick? You know, if you're rich, you can you can buy a ventilator, you can buy a respirator. But if you're poor, you can't even go to the hospital, let alone to a doctor. You know, our faith gives us everything we need to be fully alive in the face of challenges like this, to be fully active in the political arena, to be fully charged for not only caring for ourselves, but reaching out and serving and caring for others.
I've been speaking with Reverend Steve Peters. For This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell.
I'm staying alive.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from John Dye V and Michael Taylor Gray, produced by Brian DeShazer, from Outcaster Sarah, produced by Mark Sofus, and from Lucia Chappell. Beggy Lee, Jake Holmes, and the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Together with all of our listener donors, they make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 2MIA Griffith, New South Wales, WORT Madison, Wisconsin, KXSU Seattle, Washington, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay home if you can, and stay tuned.